So, are you all ready for this?
Start with your heads
okay,
down.
Everybody.
Now look up slowly. Bring your arms up and bring them down.
All right, we got some new theme music today.
Up again, both arms.
Yay!
Death metal!
Turn them down.
Peter, you love to the metal.
Bring your thumbs to yourself. And down.
Y'all hearing this?
Low to high.
No.
No, it doesn't play for us.
Don't catch.
This from Silent Bob.
All right. Well, we want to welcome everybody out to another Ruby Rogues podcast. Today we have on our panel James Edward Gray from Gray Productions. We have Aaron Patterson from AT&T Interactive. We have Peter Cooper from Ruby Inside and Rails Inside and Coder.io. Fernand, I don't know who you work for, or I didn't do my homework that way. So you want to fill us in?
Sure. Actually, I'm self-employed software consultant. I've been doing that for over a year and a half, 2 years now, and I host the Derailed Rails users group in Denver, Colorado. And I've contributed, several open source projects, the Mall, Zia for graphic packaging for Rails, and, our house, a home automation system built on top of Ruby. So that's the short description of me.
All right. And I'm Charles Max Wood from Teach Me to Code. All right, so this week we're going to be talking about databases. And usually what we do to start out is we actually start going around the panel and ask what databases people are using or have used. There's a lot out there, and I really, instead of jumping into that, I'm a little bit curious as to where people come down as far as SQL or NoSQL. So we're going to go around the panel and ask that instead. Let's go ahead and start with Aaron.
Oh boy, NoSQL or SQL?
Way to put him on the spot. He's freshly back from RailsConf.
I think that you should. I'm a fan of NoSQL, but no is into NoSQL. So I'm a fan of SQL.
Okay.
But really, I don't actually particularly care. I just use whichever one is best suited for the job. So yeah.
That makes sense.
That's lame, I know. Not super exciting.
That's okay. James, what do you prefer? SQL or NoSQL?
I only use SQL Server. That's it. Nothing else. Oh, I'm kidding. I like a wide variety of tools. I do a lot of work with both Postgres and MySQL. I definitely favor Postgres these days, and I think it's time we all just move over there and forget about MySQL. But as far as NoSQL tools, I do use those a ton, too. I'm a big Redis user and lover. I was really into Tokyo Cabinet for a long time until they basically abandoned it for Kyoto Cabinet, and that kind of turned me off. So I don't tend to use that as much anymore. I've used Beanstalk for QA and various databases, NoSQL databases. But I would definitely say Redis is probably my favorite. And then sometimes, I've been known to throw stuff in a flat file, too. I like to play with lots of different approaches to data.
How about CSV?
CSV, I've never used that, ever. Okay, I use it sometimes.
All right, Fernand, what are you using?
I use Access on all my projects. just kidding. Definitely use a lot of relational database, Postgres, MySQL. I think it really depends, on the type of project you are handling, the size of the database, what your data set is going to look like. I do like NoSQL solutions when you have requirements where the schema is loosely defined. For that, actually, throwing a bone out there, I really like MongoDB. I've used it on several occasions, and definitely, for logging stuff, where you have perhaps, not so well defined type of data structures, I think it works really well. I like the way you query in Mongo. I think it's very, very intuitive, coming from an SQL background. I also liked it, I've used it on one project where we, it's kind of, funny oxymoron type stuff, but it's basically throwable databases. So, you can build a database, play with it, run some reports or statistics and throw it away. And I think, Mongo worked really, really well for that because, it's very simple, to create a database, to populate it, and to experiment with it, and then, let it go. So it's, a transient persistent story in a way. And of course, I've used, Toko Cabinet and Redis, which I think, are good solutions. But again, it depends on your, problem area and the requirements that you have for your project.
All right, terrific. How about you, Peter? What have you been using?
Yeah, I'm a bit like Aaron, I guess. It's that I like to, I don't really care too much about what I use. But unlike Aaron, I kind of use the wrong tool for the right job. Which kind of, I mean that I often just like kind of respond to whatever the current fad is. Like, I used to literally just stick to MySQL the whole time, sort of like up to quite a level as well. I got pretty good with it, sort of running some big deployment with it. But then, everyone who's kind of done that with MySQL knows all the problems that are involved there. So when the NoSQL thing started to come along, I did have a play with various things that kind of got swept up with the MongoDB fad briefly. I still use it here and there, but not with any anger, just mostly because I don't really like the APIs to it. I think that's become an important thing for me. It's the APIs that hook into these things is just as important as the underlying technology, since I'm not a complete database head. But then also, this is a nice admission on my part, I actually do really like, however you want to pronounce it, SQLite, SQLite, whatever. I do really like it. Just for, if you're working on something that's like a prototype or even something really small, something that doesn't get a lot of traffic. So, for example, RubyFlow, for example. When I started building that, I thought it was kind of when they just first changed the default in Rails to using SQLite instead of the MySQL like demands that were in there. I just thought, let's give this a go. And it just worked. And then I kind of deployed it. I was like, well, I haven't got time to migrate this to MySQL. And I've just left it on there, and it's been fine. Not a single problem. So I am actually a big fan of rolling stuff out on SQLite where it makes sense. So, Oh, and also, just like I think it was James mentioned, Redis. Massive fan of Redis. But it's just not quite easy enough to deal with like multiple databases and stuff like in a very logical way with that for me to like be using it for every single thing. But for where it makes sense, I love it a bit. It's great. So that's me.
Super.
I love SQLite. I'm so glad Peter brought it up because I totally forgot to mention it. And I've actually scaled it to some pretty high levels. If you have a kind of site where your user data is totally separate from all other user data, like, it's a internal data only that you would never share with anybody else, sometimes I'll set that up and I'll just make a SQLite database for each user. And then in that, the connections are coming in, I'll set up a connection to the right file and then just use that throughout the request. And that scales beautifully, very far.
SQLite's great. I love it because you can hack it.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's super easy to embed. It's super easy to use. It's also fun because you can easily do in-memory databases, which is really fun. So if you want to just create a database and throw it away, you don't even have to worry about it. It's awesome.
And then works with Active Record, which is good.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the other awesome thing about in-memory databases, you can build an in-memory database and then dump it to the file system if you want. So like a couple of times where I've had to do like a whole bunch of processing really quick, I build up the whole thing in memory and then dump it to the file system, it's dramatically faster than dumping it all as you go.
So a bit like the Redis approach.
Right, exactly.
I actually worked for a company that stored settings for each user in a SQLite database, and that SQLite database was stored as binary data in the MySQL database, which was
Wow.
And
I don't think I would recommend that.
Yeah, I don't know that I would either. I don't know if any of the guys that did it would either. But anyway, it was interesting, and it's interesting to know that there is a possibility of doing something like that.
Was that at Lehman Brothers?
No.
Yeah. If you are playing with SQLite, there's a underloved plugin for it, or a Ruby library for it extension. It's called Amalgalite by Jeremy Heingardner, and it embeds SQLite in the extension. So I like it way better than the library that Rails uses for SQLite.
What? Why?
Sorry. Because it embeds SQLite in the extension. So whenever I use the version that Rails uses, then I deploy it to the production server, and it has a different version of SQLite. And since it just dynamically links to that, I get bugs and stuff in my SQL code. Whereas if I have SQLite embedded in the extension like it was meant to be embedded in an extension, then I don't have that problem because the SQLite code is right there.
That's how Perl does it. The DBD MySQL, DBD SQLite module actually includes it right in there.
Yeah, that's
so the same approach.
That's the way the SQLite team tells you to embed SQLite. So
can I clarify really quickly? What you're saying is that the deal in Rails binds to a C library, and the other one is pure Ruby.
No.
The other one
is all C as well. It's just that it ships with the SQLite C code embedded.
Okay.
And so, SQLite is an embedded database, so that's what you're supposed to do with it. You're supposed to embed it.
Okay.
You've been told.
Yeah, but then you have to deal with compilation problems on all the systems. I don't want to deal with that.
Compilation problem? Yeah, yeah. I guess I do see that aspect of it, but I don't know. I think linking against a DLL is probably about equal evil, in my opinion.
SQLite is a good compile, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never had a problem with it.
Exactly. I can't ever think of a place I've tried to compile SQLite and it didn't just work.
But have you tried compiling on like Solaris or AIX or something like that?
Atari ST.
No, but I've never tried running my Rails app there either.
So one of these days, you know, you start running a project like that, and then all of a sudden you get a bug report that's like, can't compile this on AIX, and you're just like, what?
So I have to ask two questions then, and the first one is, what was the name of that library again, James?
Amalgalite.
Mm-hmm. And then the second question is MySQL or Solaris or whatever, we're all talking about Oracle, right? I mean, Oracle owns all of those properties, right?
Oracle owns MySQL.
Okay. I'm surprised nobody brought up Oracle as a database.
what's
you guys feeling on that?
Yeah, aren't we all using that? I mean, come on.
We use Oracle at work.
You do?
Yeah.
Because he works for an enterprise.
They can afford it.
Yes.
Yeah. I work for a university that used it, and the DBAs had to have like special certifications and stuff to deal with it, and it was.
Yeah, it's a acquired
of insanity.
Yeah. So I'm a little curious, and this is more for my edification than, and my ignorance, I guess, but it seems like there are a lot of MySQL haters, or at least. We prefer anything other than MySQL. I'm wondering, what is it because you like the other databases better, or is there something in particular you don't like about MySQL?
Ooh, let's go around the room on that one.
I'll go first. I don't hate MySQL at all. I don't actually hate any particular technology. I just wouldn't use it, and that comes from a few things. First off, I don't like the licensing. I don't like that it's GPL. So that causes problems with like dealing with, for example, C extensions. When you link against libmysql, do you have to follow the GPL clause or is MIT okay? And I am a programmer. I can't, like, I don't have the mind to think about problems like that. Whereas with SQLite, it's public domain. Don't even have to think about it. Mm-hmm. Totally free to use it.
What about Postgres? And
Postgres is MIT.
MIT.
Okay. The other thing I don't like about MySQL simply comes from the underlying protocol and how you actually use the C libraries. Like when you do prepared statements versus regular statements, the data types that come back are different. So that makes writing an adapter around their API kind of difficult because you can't say that the return value is consistent. For example, if you select a date using the normal statement or using the normal API, you get a string back. Whereas if you select it using the prepared statement API, you get a special struct back. So you have to put special cases in your code to deal with those situations. And I mean, that's stuff we wrap up in Active Record, so most people don't have to deal with it, but I have to deal with it, and it's a headache for me.
Okay.
Peter, you chimed in. You said you like MySQL?
I was just saying, I like it, but just for all the bad reasons that people like MySQL, which is the fact, you know, in the past, less so now, but in the past, you know, it's very easy to install, very easy to get going with, integrate with everything. You know, Postgres, I mean, I must admit, I have very little experience with Postgres, but, you know, and I think things have changed in that department over the last few years. But like when I was looking at it 3-4 years ago, it was quite an opaque process. It was one of these kind of like, you know, really dense text files, and you had to like hook this up, chmod this. And, you know, there was a lot of work to be done and, you know, a lot of hoops to jump through. Hopefully they've improved that. But MySQL, you know, just was a lot easier back in the day.
Yeah, I've been using MySQL, but it's mainly because that's what I've been using forever. So, you know, I've always been curious as to why people prefer, you know, one over the other. And so, Aaron brought up some interesting reasons to look into Postgres or some of these others. James, you keep bringing up that you like Postgres a lot better than MySQL. Are there any particular reasons or capabilities or anything that you see in Postgres that's not in MySQL?
Absolutely. I was a big MySQL fan for a long time too, and kind of late making the switch just because that's what I learned on, and so that's what I was comfortable with. But I was like Peter. I looked at Postgres a couple of times in the past. I thought, man, it's kind of a pain in the butt to get into. I definitely feel it's gotten better, to answer Peter's point. Especially if you use Homebrew. I mean, it's just, you know, Homebrew, install Postgres, and you're done, you know. I really like that. And then once you get into Postgres and you realize that it really is a great database, and it's built with a great feature set in mind, and I mean, just all the time you're finding stuff in there that you just love. It's so capable. So David Brady, who couldn't join us today, actually wrote an email telling us that once upon a time, he implemented an adventure game, a small text adventure game, using Postgres scripting language. And that's a great example of how powerful Postgres is and how easy it is to do things. So like, I've been promoting a Qt Classic library for Ruby lately that I saw at Red Dirt, and it's a Qt system implemented inside of Postgres using its amazing locking capabilities and its publish subscribe that's built in and stuff like that. Aaron was just showing off HStore, which is Postgres built-in NoSQL key value store. He was showing that off in his keynote at RailsConf. So, you know, it's once you get into Postgres and you realize there's just tons of features in there and so many things that, like, you have to do when you're on MySQL. Like, when you're on MySQL and you're ready to add text search, it's like, okay, which thing am I going to go get to do text search? Because you can't really do it in MySQL. I mean, you kind of can if you switch tables, but that gets into one of MySQL's major weaknesses, how switching tables is like horrible and you know, you lose some features and gain others. Whereas Postgres just has that built right in, full text search, you know, you just set it up and you're done. So Postgres is definitely a programmer's database in my opinion.
You're selling me.
Yeah, I was gonna say you said full text search is built in, and yeah, it's, I'm just like, oh yeah, okay, I can do that.
We're listening.
No kidding. Fernand, do you have an opinion on this?
Kind of. You know, actually, I'm more like a You know, I like things, you know, keep things simple. So, you know, initially, and I think it all depends on your requirements and what type of application you're actually building, right? I mean, you know, I think MySQL, I mean, that's my personal opinion. I think it's fine, you know, if you're dealing, you know, with, you know, tens of thousands of records, you know, or, you know, not in the scale of like millions and millions and perhaps, you know, lots of updates to the database. I mean, that's a simple way in. I agree with Peter, you know, the install is that simple. You know, it's the distribution is pretty, you know, wide. So it's, you know, easy to get it on your system. So I kind of like to start there. It's almost like this kind of makes me think, you know, of, in a way, you know, like a performance, you know, optimization type scenarios where, you know, you kind of like, you know, if you try to put in your performance, you know, prior to getting something done, you know, you're going to end up doing it over and over again. So I think, you know, I think any database solution is probably fine, you know, until you get a phone call at 3 a.m., you know, with, you know, your application is crapping out. So I think really, use the best tool for the job and basically try to figure out, you know, where you're going to be the most efficient debugging and finding the issue with your database tool. So I think, you know, it kind of brings up, you know, another argument, you know, related to database, and you know, can expand on that. But, you know, I will coin it as the Guido's principle, which kind of states that, you know, you keep assigning tasks to a great developer and expecting him to be a good database admin or a good sysadmin. I think, you know, there's also, you know, perhaps, you know, due to cost measure and things like that. But I think if you're really doing a lot of database, you know, within your application, a lot of database, you know, requirements such as, you know, replication, or you are dealing with, you know, millions or terabytes, you know, worth of data, then also, you know, is the developer the best person to actually make those kind of decisions versus bringing in, you know, a database administrator into your organization?
Right.
So that's, you know, that's kind of like, you know, I think everybody's got chops, you know, in database and or sysadmin for that matter. But, you know, where do you get to a point where you're getting diminishing returns, right?
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a really good point, actually. I think that in our industry, we tend to just have the developer do all the database work, you know, but there are actually people that know how to do that crap, you know, and are better at it than we are, no matter what we tell ourselves. And sometimes a project is big enough that you probably ought to take that seriously and use a professional, you know.
Yeah, I agree. One thing that Fernand brought up too was kind of using the right tool for the job and also using the right tool for you. I kind of got both of those out of that. But in using the right tool for the job, I mean, there are a lot of different types of databases and a lot of different problems that they solve. And so I'm going to kind of go through some of the different types of databases and get some opinions on what they're good for and what people might be using them for that they ought to reconsider. And the first one that I want to ask about is the key value type database. And so you have things like Memcached or Redis or Tokyo Cabinet, I think, is also a key value. I might be wrong on that.
It is.
But what are those good for? What problems do they solve well?
So I would say they're great for when you want a big hash in the sky, is basically what they're good for. And then they all have their different flavors. Like, for example, Memcache is still the best of the best for the simple caches, in my opinion. And I really like it for that. It has better expiration than Redis. It has better memory adjustments than Redis. So I think it really... No, I think it excels at that.
I hear dissent. Peter?
I know. Peter, what do you think?
No, I just in all of my experiments, I used Memcache a few years ago now, so... It may well have improved, but just in like very, very basic tests, I just found Memcache to be, I found it slower than Redis for a start, not by a massive amount, but a little bit, But no, I just find Redis to be a lot more configurable, like on the memory side of things. But I mean, I guess you know, he's been adding in a lot more stuff recently, like, you know, the different types of storage systems that are going to be coming in, and, you know, this and that. I guess perhaps I see a lot more promise in Redis than Memcache going forward.
I just
prefer the configuration of it as is now. I just find it a lot more configurable than Memcache.
So I will agree that Redis is very configurable, but actually what I was referring to, and I didn't make this clear, Memcache uses better algorithms for some things. Like, for example, when you set a time to live on a key in Memcache and you set it for 10 minutes, but then you keep reading that key over and over again, it's 10 minutes from the last time you read that key. When you set, so basically if the data stays hot, it stays in memory. When you set a time to live in Redis as 10 minutes, then that means 10 minutes. And even if you're accessing the heck out of it, 10 minutes from now is gone.
Oh, sure.
So that, I think, makes it not as good a choice for cache handling and stuff like that. In Redis, you can fix that, but you have to also do a write to the key to update the time to live, basically, which kind of kills the point, in my opinion. And then the other thing, when I said memory and Memcache, when Memcache runs out of memory, it uses a more intelligent algorithm to expire the keys, and it will favor keys that are getting less usage or haven't been used in a long time. So it tends to do a better job of dropping things out of the cache that are old and not really being used anymore. Whereas Redis uses a very simple, fast algorithm, but doesn't do as good a job at expiring the right things.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So I still think Memcache is king on caches. Redis is kind of like, to me, in my opinion, it's the ultimate networking toolkit database. It's basically like if you want a data structure on the network that you can share, you know, between processes, requests, whatever, I think Redis really kills that. It's really good for real-time statistics. Like, for a while, it was used to do those download counts on rubygems.org, whereas people would download, it would increment counters in Redis, and then you could go sit on the page and watch it update. That was an excellent use of Redis. And then Tokyo Cabinet is basically kind of falling into obscurity, so I won't even bother to say what I think it's good for anymore. It's people are probably leaving it behind.
All right. Anyone else want to chime in on that? Aaron?
All at once.
Well, we've only used, pretty much NoSQL stuff that I've used in production. We typically use it for caches, really. Like, I've never had to scale up Mongo at all. The databases I have had to scale up are Oracle and MySQL. But the MySQL times, like, we used MySQL for millions of rows, but the only time we used it for that was a read-only cache. So I've never had to deal with it for writes. Uh-huh. As far as I can tell, it seems bad if we had to deal with it for writes. But as far as, like, NoSQL stuff, really I've only used it for cache, and we typically use Memcache or Tokyo Cabinet, but I guess we're switching off that because of stuff that James is talking about. But yeah, I don't know.
All right.
I totally agree with James, you know, on the Memcache versus Redis. You know, I just wanted to add a note. So, you know, there is features, you know, as James pointed out, I think, you know, in Postgres to basically, you know, embed hashes, you know, in a column on a table. But, you know, I also think that, you know, this is fine, and, you know, Postgres obviously, you know, gives you some hooks, you know, to, you know, query there. But I think if you start getting into those, you know, areas, it's kind of like somewhat of a gray area to me, and that's where, you know, you may want to consider, you know, a NoSQL solution, because if you're starting stashing, you know, hash of values, you know, inside, you know, a colon, and, you know, and you're starting getting it down that path, you probably want to step back and look at what you're going to actually do with that data. And I think, you know, that's where you may want to consider, you know, a NoSQL type solution, especially knowing how you actually want to query and extract that data back out. And I think, you know, when I look at stuff, you know, as far as NoSQL solution, you know, again, I'll bring up Mongo because that's the one that I know the most and I've used. You know, it's very easy to actually start, you know, pushing, you know, some data into that store, and especially if you want to, you know, extract some reporting or statistics out of it. So I think that's, you know, I think a good case, a good use case scenario for considering a NoSQL solution.
So now that we're moving to Mongo, Mongo is more of a document database than a key value store, which is a little bit different in that it's basically more like instead of a hash in the sky, it's more like a hash of hashes in the sky, right? Kind of.
Right.
Hash squared.
Have you used it in production, James?
So no, I haven't. I've played with it a couple of times, and I have. So there's like something I really like about Mongo, which I think it's a real developer-friendly database, and I like that about it. And like Fernand says, when you're getting into scenarios where your data is changing a lot, the schema version of it, you know, or things like that, then it seems like it's almost an ideal tool. The thing that continually scares me off of Mongo is I worry that some of the production concerns have like never been addressed. Like I can't get anybody to realistically tell me how you're supposed to back up a Mongo database without taking it offline. I mean, like, seriously, back it up, you know, just drop a backup, you know, or things like that. They kind of worry me about putting it into production. And maybe it's just that I haven't dug deep enough in that world and found the right thing. So I'm a little bit scared of putting it in production.
I've heard the same things, especially after this the Amazon outage. I heard some horror stories after that, like not being able to recover a Mongo database.
I've heard that too. I've also heard that Mongo, I think it's Mongo. In fact, I'm almost positive it was because I was talking to somebody about it. It logs the queries that come in to a log, and so you can basically play it back and get your database back depending on when you took a snapshot of that file. But it's kind of an eventual consistency thing. It doesn't do it on every query. It does it every so often. So you do run the risk of not being able to get everything back if you're backing up that file.
Yeah, I think, sorry, go ahead, Aaron, sorry.
No, that's just why I was going to say why I typically use these things as caches so that I have, like, you know, in case the thing dies, I can rebuild it from, say, a regular SQL database.
Yeah, I think, you know, I agree with you guys. I mean, that's definitely been a flaw, you know, with Mongo. And, you know, I'm kind of out of date. I don't know if they have actually addressed some of those issues. But I think, you know, and perhaps, you know, you can extrapolate that to be more generalistic. But I think, you know, if you do look at NoSQL, I think it might be advantageous to also know whether you can actually recreate the database in case, you know, you run into those issues where, you know, something gets corrupted or you're losing things. And I think, you know, a good scenario, especially for Mongo, is that, you know, you can put it in there, but you can either rebuild it or you don't really care about, you know, the accuracy of the data for that matter, right? So the two cases where I thought, you know, it was a good match is for basically, you know, logging, you know, some kind of events, you know, coming out of your application where, you know, just having every single logs may not actually matter all that much, or the ability to actually be able to dump it to a Mongo instance, you know, run some queries, do some reporting, and then, you know, throw it away or be able to rebuild it. So I think that's a good scenario for that.
That's really interesting. I've talked to a few people about what is it, data warehousing, and mm-hmm. and that might be really interesting. Where because with data warehousing, what you effectively do is flatten your data so that you don't have to worry about joins and this and that, and then you do the queries on it. And I can see where that would be handy in Mongo. I also started, just as kind of a fun little project, I started writing a blog engine on Sinatra and used MongoDB as my back end. And, you know, you can stop and start Mongo and it'll you know, shut off your database and then bring it back up. So it is persistently storing it. And I haven't really looked at where or how, but You know, just interesting things. It really is nice too if you have. I kind of liked it for the fact that I could let people then extend the blog engine eventually, and effectively just add fields to the posts or whatever on the blog without actually worrying about the actual schema.
Right, I think that's the interesting thing, because really, I guess I disagree with you, James, on that. It really is more than a hash of hash, because you can actually, you don't have to traverse the whole thing, because you do have a query language that you can leverage to navigate ad hoc, you know, the document hierarchies. But I think that's kind of attractive about Mongo. That's to your point, Charlie.
Yeah, that's a good point. But Fernand makes a good point there. And even to go one further, Mongo can actually have things nested in its fields, you know, almost like hash and a hash and a hash, and you can still query across it. So that is kind of neat. Go ahead.
Sorry, the other thing too, I'm thinking about this, it just triggered a point here, James, is, you know, the other cool thing about Mongo is that people may want to think about too, is that, you know, because it is so flexible, because there's no predefined schema and it's easy to modify schema on the fly, I found it also kind of interesting to basically refine your schema. You know, if you do have, you know, you can experiment with it and look at the queries and look at how you're going to, you know, traverse down, you know, the hierarchy, and basically kind of maybe use it as a prototyping tool to figure out, you know, how the best way to set your schema up together, right? So that's kind of an interesting thing too.
This is an interesting idea. I really like the point Aaron and Fernand made a bit back, where they basically said, you know, use the relational database as the, you know, the authority, and then when you go to these external tools, put what you need in there to use them, but then maintain the database as the authority. I do try to do that whenever I can. Like, even in my background jobs, I may use like Rescue or Beanstalk or something to throw the jobs in. But I always make sure that I could, you know, if the entire queue just gets blown away, I don't even care, because I can just re-queue everything. And I usually have a rake task to do exactly that, to come through the database and re-queue everything.
So that's another thing that I really wanted to touch on, at least, is I'm a little bit curious as far as some of these database-backed queues. I mean, you have things as simple as in a delayed job, you know, where it basically just adds a table and fields to the database and then just, you know, has a daemon that queries it and runs, you know, but you also have things like Rescue and Beanstalk that, you know, back up onto something else, you know, like Redis, and then, you know, basically just pull stuff off the queue in order.
Mm-hmm. So which ones are you asking, which ones do we like?
I'm curious about which ones you like, and I'm curious as well as to, you know, how those fare versus the ones that just seem to use their own internal storage of in some way, you know, in memory storage or something to store the queue structure itself.
Okay, so should we go around the table on queues?
Sure.
Yeah, let's just do it really quickly, because it's not core to what we're talking about, but it is something that's interesting.
Okay.
So yeah, just go ahead and we'll just start with you, James.
So as far as queues go, there's, you know, basically, like you said, attempts to do it in a relational database. Probably the two that we should talk about in those are delayed job, which works very well as far as just being very simple to integrate with the Rails app. And if you have moderate queuing needs, it's going to be fine. It's all you ever need, really. The minus of delayed job is it's using a relational database for something they don't particularly excel at. So if you get data to a certain point, it's basically going to fall off a cliff, just because relational database kind of suck at that kind of thing. So that's a example of it. The library I mentioned earlier, QClassic, does it in Postgres using Postgres locking and publish-subscribe. That's a little bit better just because, well, Postgres has way more same locking. And so that's probably a better solution if you're on Postgres. And then there's, you know, really queues that are really queues, like Beanstalk and probably AMPQ, RabbitMQ kind of thing that people know. The problem with the AMPQ kind of stuff, it's a really great, powerful queue and way overcomplicated, which is, I think, makes working with it not friendly. Beanstalk is almost exactly the opposite of that, and the minimal queue that could possibly work, and it's very good about that in every aspect except introspection, which is where it has problems. You can't really, like, you know, look at what jobs are in the queue and stuff like that. So probably a pretty good balance of those, in my opinion, is Rescue, which is, you know, the Redis back queue. Redis does perform pretty well for that kind of stuff. You can queue it up and you get the introspection. So generally, I've been favoring Rescue lately.
Anyone else?
I agree with James' statement. You know, one thing for me that I'm not really big on, you know, is, and I guess that we can touch back to a database, and, you know, I know we talked about, you know, searching, text queries type stuff. I think, you know, I mean, to me, you know, it's almost like, you know, Redis, you know, happened to be, you know, the backup mechanism, you know, for a rescue, you know, strategy, but I'm not too big on it. I mean, I think the, you know, it's that simple to install. So, you know, if you do have minimum requirements, you know, for queuing, I think that works well. But I think, you know, Beanstalk is, you know, I really liked it because it's, you know, really that simple to install, like James, you know, is mentioning. But I think also there's limitation there. So, you know, if you do have some pretty advanced, you know, queuing strategies and queuing mechanism, you know, like priorities and things like that, I think, you know, Beanstalks or AMPQ, you know, might be better candidates for that. But AMPQ, I mean, you know, it's almost like a rectal exam just to get it installed anywhere. You know? So it's pretty painful to actually deal with the installation process, in my opinion. But also, I guess that brings up the question of, you know, like, for text searching, yeah, you know, it is supported, you know, in MySQL and it is supported in Postgres, but is it actually, you know, the best thing? I mean, it could be, you know, if you have simple requirements for text searching, that may be the option, but should it be, you know, part of your decision versus considering, you know, a Sphinx or Solr solution? So I guess that would be a good question, I guess, for the panel.
So just to hit back on that one real quick, Postgres offers two different text searching indexes for different strategies of text searching, and they're real inverted indexes, like you're supposed to do a text search like Sphinx does. So I think it's a very different scenario comparing MySQL's text search to Postgres.
Okay. All right. Now, there's one more thing I want to dive into, and we're already hitting the edge of our time contract as far as the episode goes, but I'm curious if any of you guys have done anything with some of the column-based databases like Cassandra or, you know, kind of the big table approach like Hadoop.
I haven't played with those yet. They're on my list of things to play with. I would like to try messing with Cassandra a little. I've messed with Amazon SimpleDB a little bit, and which isn't really a column database. It's just different. I ran into a few problems with it and didn't really enjoy it. But I do want to play with Cassandra. I also want to play with Couch. I know it's been out a while, and it's not as popular as Mongo, but it looks like it's also way more robust than Mongo as far as like data integrity and stuff. So I kind of want to play with Cassandra and Couch at some point, but I haven't yet.
All right, anyone else? All right, well, let's jump into the picks then. I'm going to go ahead and start with Peter this time. Peter, what are your picks for this week?
Well, I guess this is probably relevant to the database thing, just because you guys mentioned it earlier. I am actually using MongoDB in production, so I thought, hang on, I've got to go and look up how the backup system's working for this. Yeah, there's just a thing that comes with Mongo called Mongo Dump, and it does hot database backup from, you know, it kind of pauses like the writing to disk and does it all for you. So that's what I'm using. But the problem with Mongo is you do have to spend a lot of time digging through their wiki just to find out stuff. about things like that. So that might be why some people have not, you know, been able to find it. But it is in there. It is a part of Mongo. And yeah, so I guess that's a pick in a sense. Other than that, something that I wanted to mention was like a thing in the Ruby world this week was a tool called Mailcatcher, which, like, you've probably seen these apps that allow you to, like, send email, like, locally within your system, like, from your Rails web app you're working on or whatever, and then kind of preview it. I think there's one around that's, like, $40, and, like, everyone uses it. It's really popular. But this Mailcatcher is totally free. It's basically an all-in-one Ruby app that runs an event machine loop, and then within that runs a Sinatra app and an SMTP server all at once. And then basically you send mail to it. You load up the Sinatra web app on localhost. It puts it on port 1080, I think. And then literally the emails come into it in real time. It uses like WebSockets to keep it up to date. So as soon as you send email into that, blam, it comes up. And you can, you know, dig into the HTML, the plain text, the source, all that kind of stuff. So I'll send over the link for that so you can include that. But I was just kind of impressed. And, you know, I knew you could do all that kind of stuff with Event Machine and, you know, run different daemon processes at the same time, or different daemons at the same time. But it was just kind of cute seeing it in, like, a really small example, and it's entirely open source, so I was impressed with that. And I guess just to throw one other thing in, there's Remy Sharp, the JavaScript guy, has been working on something called Inliner, which the description on it kind of reminds me a bit Aaron-esque, actually. He basically says, inline the crap out of your site. And then he's kind of put like a heart, you know, work offline, love mobile, all this kind of stuff. So basically what it does is it just takes like a web page, you put in the URL, it takes all the images, CSS, JavaScript, everything, just compresses it all down into a single file using like data URLs and all that kind of stuff. With a cache manifest, so then you can like use it anywhere. Interesting stuff, interesting development. So I'll send a link to that as well.
All right. Cool. Aaron?
I'm going to go with, this week, I am going to go with Scheme.
Scheme?
Yes. specifically Chicken Scheme. I don't know why, it's just been what I've been playing with it for a while. It's totally awesome. If you want to learn Scheme, you should check out Chicken Scheme. I like it a lot because it's not... it seems like a more practical scheme. Like if you go get Racket, it's, you know, sometimes kind of slow and stuff. But Chicken Scheme is very fast and is a practical scheme to use, fun to play with, and pretty much everything in the language is a pun of some sort. For example, they have gems, but they call them eggs. So. if you go into their IRC channel, which is Pound Chicken, everybody's super friendly, and you are typically greeted with buck buck buck. So I approve. You should check it out. So Chicken Scheme.
Man, on IRC and Ruby Dash Lang, we should respond with like cha-ching or something. I
don't know. That's right.
All right, so. Any other picks, Aaron, before we move on? I kind of cut you off.
I can't think of anything else. Chicken Scheme, check it out.
All right, James, what do you got?
So we have all those apps that, you know, eat tabs in our browser now. You know, you gotta have one tab open with Gmail, and if you got like Campfire and stuff like that, that drives me crazy. I can't stand having tabs in my browser eaten up because I already need like 50 of them to build my website, so I don't have any more to give. They're all used up.
There's a solution for that?
There's a solution for that. Yes, there is. Actually, there's multiple. I'll recommend multiple. First of all, my favorite email client now is Mailplane, and it does is take Gmail and stick it into an external app and tie it in through all the Mac system. So like you can access the Mac address book, you can easily, you know, do attachments in a very Mac-like way, et cetera. But it's literally the Gmail interface. You'll see it and it looks exactly like Gmail because it is. It's just running Gmail inside of this external app. So that's my favorite way to get Gmail out of the browser. And then if you want a more general solution for that doesn't, you know, for whatever specific app you want to do it with, Facebook, GitHub, or Campfire, or whatever, It's Fluid is the name of the app. It's at fluidapp.com, and it basically just lets you make applications out of websites. So that's how you get them out of your browser tabs.
All right. Now, the mail one, what was it again? Mail claim?
Claim. P-L-A-N-E.
Mail plane.
Mm-hmm.
I would have never found it for the show notes. All right. Keep going.
That's it. That's all I got.
All right. I'm going to jump in next. I made a discovery of LastPass. It's kind of like 1Password, except it doesn't seem to be in my way as much. And from what I understand, it also gives you the option of sharing your password with somebody else. Now, by sharing, it doesn't mean that it gives them the password. It just means that if they're using LastPass, that it will autofill your credentials for that website in for them. And this is relevant because my other pick is Contemporary VA. I hired myself a virtual assistant because I have been so busy that I needed somebody to take stuff off of my plate. And so anyway, my virtual assistant actually went in to teach me to code. And I migrated everything over to a new server and to a new WordPress installation. And when I did that, it messed up the enclosures on the screencasts. And she just went in and fixed them for me this morning. And I didn't have to do anything except email her and say, move this information to here. And so it's been super nice. So it's Contemporary VA. I have a 20-hour a month retainer with them. And it's I've been using them for a couple of days. And it has been so nice. The last one that I want to put up there is VimGolf, vimgolf.com. I've spent countless hours lately playing with VimGolf while I'm waiting for different activities to happen with different websites. And, you know, it only takes a second to do a submission. But anyway, what you do is you gem install VimGolf, and then from there you do Vim puts, and then or VimGolf puts, and then whatever the number is for the puzzle that you're trying to solve. And then what it does is it counts up the keystrokes that you use to edit the file and then save and exit. And it tells you how many keystrokes it took. And so on my way up, I went all the way to the bottom of VimGolf and worked on the very first puzzle. And yeah, I saw James Edward Gray on my way up and passed him. So anyway, VimGolf has been, I have learned a ton about Vim in the last couple of days just from VimGolf, because they show you the people who have done just a little bit better than you. And so I pick up some of the tricks that they've used, and then I use some of the other tricks that I've learned and usually wind up moving up. And anyway, it's been really cool.
Good, you need to school me, because my Vim's terrible, obviously.
All right, Fernan, I don't think we explained really what the picks are. I'm sure you've kind of gotten an idea, but basically the idea is that there are things that we use. It doesn't have to be just in our coding, but just in general that make our lives easier, and you know, or just fun things. You know, if there's a novel that you really enjoyed, or you know, there's a coding tool that you like, or a library that you think everyone should try, or anything like that. You know, just share it with us. So are there any things that have that you want to share with us that you've been using recently?
Yeah, sure. I guess I got a few. You know, one that I shared with James, and I think he really digged it, was a jQuery template that basically allows you to, you know, generate, you know, HTML tags within your jQuery scripts. I think, you know, I really dig it. I think it's very easy to use and flexible. There's another thing, I guess, related to the theme that we're talking about today, and that's something that I saw out of RailsConf last week, and it looks pretty cool. That's something that I kind of wanted, you know, with Rails for a while, which is basically the ability to batch, you know, SQL statements. It's a bulk API, I think, and I think it's mainly being used with Sprout Core. And, you know, I started looking at that, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to best integrate it, you know, within the Rails application. I think it looks pretty cool. I think it's still under a lot of development at the moment. And then a service I've been using that I think is really great is the getaround.com, which basically allows you to rent your car to your friends while you're not using it, so you can make money when your car is parked. I think it's really cool. And actually, Joe, if you're listening to this podcast, can you bring my car back? Just kidding. It's kind of an interesting idea. I think it's worth checking it out.
All right, that sounds interesting. Now, it was what was the API that you were saying? I didn't quite catch that.
Oh, I send you the it's bulk underscore API. I'll send you the link, Charlie.
Okay, sounds good. All right, well, I think that's it. So, whoa, had that a little loud. All right, well, I want to thank our panelists again for coming on to the podcast. We have Fernand. Thanks again for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
James Edward Gray, thank you for coming as well.
Sure.
Peter, thanks for showing up.
Thanks, guys.
Aaron, we can't see you dance on the podcast, but we appreciate you for being here.
Thank you.
I love that.
We're very glad for that.
Yeah, and I just want to...
Every day.
Absolutely. I want to thank everybody for listening. For supporting the podcast. We've gotten a lot of great feedback. And so if you have any feedback, you can email me. My email's chuck@teachmetocode.com, or anyone on the panel can probably find me and get a hold of me. Go into iTunes and leave a review. You can just click on the iTunes link in the sidebar, and that'll take you to a place where you can leave us a review. And I really appreciate it, you know. Leave a 5-star review if you can. If we don't deserve it, then leave something else. But, you know, just let us know what you think and share it with your friends.
Yeah. It's super important, actually, if they're in a different country from the U.S., because they keep all of the reviews separate. So there might not be no reviews for us, like in the U.K. or something. So if you're in a different country, review. It's much more valuable as well.
And that's only 1 star per panelist, so we definitely deserve that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, guys. We're going to wrap it up, and we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Bye. See ya.